Today's episode of The Grave Talks is brought to you by Care Of. For 50% off your first month of personalized Care Of vitamins, go to takecareof.com and enter GT50. Yes, go to takecareof.com and enter code GT50. Get 50% off your first month of personalized Care Of vitamins. Today on The Grave Talks, the Nickerson Sneed House. Generations called the Nickerson Sneed House home. Now, many of those who once lived behind these walls have returned from the dead to share a glimpse into the life they once led. Do all these spirits know that we are catching a glimpse into their former lives, or are they trying to convey a message to the living today? Today on The Grave Talks, we discuss the current and dark past of the Nickerson Sneed House with paranormal investigator Jake Fife.
Well, the Nickerson Sneed is interesting because the paranormal activity doesn't just have to do with the location, the history that took place in the home. It has to do with kind of a bleed-in of around the area. See, the original part of the Nickerson Sneed House was a two-room log cabin that was built around 1744, 1745 by Francis King Cannon. But even before Francis King Cannon came to Glade Springs, Virginia, close by Nickerson Sneed, over the ridge, about half a mile away, it was a huge gathering area for the Cherokee Native American tribes and even the Shawnee Native American tribes. And this was an area, not just that little gathering spot, but pretty much everywhere around it was kind of like a safe zone where, hey, if we run into your tribe or your war party, we won't attack you, you won't attack us, we will trade. And once a year, typically around the fall, they would gather different tribes, would come to this one place, and they would do kind of like fall rituals. They would trade with each other. They would have feasts, almost like a Thanksgiving type thing. And one of the reasons that it said that they went there was because in that general area, there was a very strong spiritual presence. And there's a local legend around there that in the woods, the spirits would hide. That was the gathering place for the spirits of the region, and that on specific nights of the year, the spirits would come out of the forest. And so these Native American tribes, they would go there hoping that they could please the spirits and contact them. And so when Francis King Cannon came there, well, first, they were kind of run out pretty quickly by some of the local militia in the area because they had had some issues with them in the past. And so Francis King Cannon, he came from Ireland, and he went to Pennsylvania, didn't really do well in Pennsylvania, and he had a brand new daughter, and he basically just wanted a fresh start. He was like, well, Pennsylvania is not really working for me. He didn't get along with some of the people. He had some problems with some of the local law enforcement from what we've been able to tell. So he was a surveyor. That's what he became when he came to America. He was originally just a regular farmer. And he started doing scouting trips into Virginia. And one of the people that he used to ride with was George Washington on scouting trips. And so he discovered this little area towards the bottom of Virginia near the North Carolina border, which is modern-day Glade Springs. And he decided in 1744 that he was going to move his entire family there, which at the time was a little crazy because no one else was living there. Now, the county militias, they would patrol through there, but pretty much everyone stayed away from that area, like I said earlier, because that was the big meeting place of these tribes, and it was known as a place where if you went there to move, you probably weren't coming back alive. And so he went against everyone's opinion and judgment, and he took his family down there, and along the way, he met a few other people, and they kind of joined and formed like a mini wagon train. And when they got to Glade Springs, he set up his little cabin, and they set it up originally as a cabin, and then they transformed it into a bit of a fort. And during the French and Indian War, it saw a little action. Most of the action in the area actually took place about a mile and a half away. There were some little skirmishes, not really anything big, but from what I've been able to gather in my research, the house was attacked at least once. And after a while, he started having some more kids, and he had this son, his oldest, Andrew King Cannon, who later became a lieutenant in the Continental Army and fought at King's Mountain during the Revolution, he started teaching him how to be a surveyor and a tracker. And that's pretty much what the King Cannons were known for. They were, if you wanted to know what was over that ridge that no one had dared go over, you asked Francis King Cannon and his son. If you wanted a road cut out, you called Mr. King Cannon. And so they started getting more friends that way. They started to make some pretty good money. And after about 10, 15 years of living pretty much alone, aside from one other family in the Great Springs area, more and more people started to go there. And Francis King Cannon did carve out a wagon road that went in front of his house, which is still there to this day. And Glade Springs started becoming what it is today. And his family oversaw everything. They owned about 85% of the town. And, you know, they were just very big figures to the point to where they had sway over the local and the county courts, which, you know, they had a few issues that popped up every once in a while, but for my record, the issues disappeared. And, you know, if you put two and two together, it's kind of easy to tell why they disappeared as fast as they did. And then when the Revolutionary War came to the area, now Francis King Cannon, he was still alive. He didn't die until about the mid-1780s. So about the Revolutionary War, he was still alive. And Glade Springs, because that was the only road in front of his house. And his house was an old decommissioned fort. It was restored back to its fort status. And it was used as a recruitment center a little bit for, you know, the local militia captains would go there. They would offer food and drink and get people to sign up. And that was the most traveled road for militias and even an army going down south to the Southern campaign. And there were some skirmishes during the Revolutionary War in West Virginia, Southern West Virginia, and then Southern Virginia. Most of the action was between Native Americans and settlers. It wasn't really American versus British. And so around the Glade Springs is the kind of action that it saw. And one of the big things that the house contributed to was it was a field hospital. And during the march to Kings Mountain, a few regiments that ended up joining the Over Mountain Men to take down Patrick Ferguson at Kings Mountain, they ended up resupplying and tending to their wounded at the Nickerson Sneed House before traveling down, you know, for the battle. So the house has had a lot of history, very interesting history. Now, Francis King Cannon and his wife did die in the house. He did expand it to another room, so it was a pretty good-sized cabin, especially for the time. And his son, who was a lieutenant now, Andrew King Cannon, he ended up taking over the house, but he sold it in the 1810s, I believe it was. And the person that ended up getting it, which is weird because there's not really records of this exact deal. It's more of like what I'm assuming it was a verbal deal. It didn't go much into handwriting. But it eventually got down to this one family. I'm wanting to say it was the Young family. I believe that was the name, but don't quote me on that. And they had an older son. And in the 1820s, he married this girl named Betsy. And Betsy was just a local girl who, you know, her family had a good bit of land in the Glade Springs area. But the Young family, you know, they basically inherited all of the King Cannon stuff. The King Cannon just said, here, we're, you know, picking up shop and we're going west. And so they just gave everything to this family. And so Betsy ended up marrying into this family, but her husband died after about a year and a half of being married. Now, they did have a son together. And so Betsy, when he died, she got the entire property. She got the estate, all the land he owned. She got the house, the servants, the slaves, which at the time was a little weird because typically, you know, you give it to your next kin, you give it back to your family, your mom, your dad, something like that. And so there was a little bit of animosity between his family and Betsy because, you know, they're like, well, who are you? You've only been here a year, year and a half with us. What makes you think you're really entitled to all of this? Mm-hmm. And then enter Dr. Nickerson Sneed. he ran a local practice, and he had a decent amount of land, but from everything I've seen, he was a very ambitious person. And I think he saw opportunity, and he very quickly struck up a relationship with Betsy, and before you know it, they got married. And so that's how it became the Nickerson Snead House. About 1828 is about when this is. And so everything, one of the first things he had done was everything was transferred into his name, not her name. That includes all the property, everything they owned. So at this point, Dr. Nickerson Snead, he still retained his old property. So kind of like King Cannon, he owned about 85% of Glade Springs. And he kept up with the old church, which Francis Kincannon had set up. He helped maintain it. He donated to the local causes. He helped his medical practice up a little bit, which he used his house for. He used one of the rooms in the cabin. They were still living in the cabin at this point. I don't see how at this point. But he was using one of the rooms as a doctor's office. And about 1835, he decides, you know, this is a little too cramped, especially with two kids now, and my doctor's practice, which is the only one in the area for like an hour and a half, 2 hours. So he starts building brick add-ons to the house. Now, something that they used to do back then is when you wanted to make an addition, you didn't exactly tear down what was there before. Now, typically, if it was a cabin, you would, because, you know, brick and cabin doesn't really go well together. It looks weird. But for some reason, Dr. Nickerson Snead, he decided to keep the cabin. And he ended up building a house around the cabin. And still to this day, if you go into the dining room portion and one of the back room portions of the Nickerson Snead house, you're walking on the exact wood floors that Francis Kincannon built in 1745. And I have seen these for myself. The loft that was, you know, the outside of the cabin, the walls, they are still there. What Dr. Nickerson did, he literally just built around, he kind of encased it inside this new house. And he made it into a two-story, very, very nice plantation house. And he added an upstairs, which was just one room. And it was kind of like a little side room upstairs, up some stairs. And that was his doctor's office. And over time, you know, the smell of, you know, sometimes people would die in his office. We aren't sure how many exactly died, but it said more than a few died in his office. The smell would kind of creep down into the house below. And so he ended up building a little bit more of an expansion around it, kind of to block in the smell, and he closed in his office a little bit more. And so, you know, the Sneeds, they had a pretty good little setup in the area. Dr. Nickerson, he was involved in some of the local markets. He basically had not really complete control of the town, but a lot of the wheeling and dealings went through him when it came to what happened in Glade Springs. And he was very instrumental in taking Glade Springs from, you know, just this, hey, there's one road in a cool little town, check it out, to, hey, this is a major depot of supply. This is where everyone with a wagon train, everyone with supplies and army stops and resupplies and, you know, takes a breather. And Dr. Nickerson Snead was very key in that. And so about in the 1850s, everything's going well. And then he started expanding a little bit more north. And some of the people that were already up there, they didn't like that. So there was a little bit of verbal exchanges between them. There was a little bit of court dealings, which Dr. Nickerson Snead eventually won. And there was the first bit of tragedy that he experienced around that time.
Back to the show and the interview in just a moment. First, I want to take a moment to thank our supporter today, Care Of, where right now you can get 50% off your first month of personalized Care Of vitamins. Not a bad offer there. Go to takecareof.com and enter code GT50. Now, Care Of is a monthly subscription vitamin service that delivers completely personalized vitamins and supplement packs right to your door. Every day, you got your own little pack. You open it up, just tear the little thing open, and there you go. There's your vitamins. Now, how do you know which ones you should be getting? Well, that's kind of the fun part. You start out with an online quiz on their website. It talks about your diet, your health goals, your lifestyle choices. It takes about 5 minutes or so. And then you find out your personal scientifically backed vitamin and supplement recommendations. I really loved it because I couldn't tell you from Adam what I should be taking or shouldn't be taking. 90% of people fall short of FDA recommended guidelines for at least one vitamin or nutrient. You can find out where you're lacking with Care/of's online quiz and get back on track in reaching your health goals. I was amazed. And I've been using Care/of now for going on almost 3 months, 4 months about now. And I'm telling you, I notice a difference. I really, really do. I love doing that quiz, and I love my pack that I get every single week. It's really hard to know, you know, what vitamins or supplements you should be taking. Care/of makes it easy to find out with what you should be getting with that quiz. And they deliver everything to you right to your door in a personalized private package. You open it up. You're like, all right, here we go for the month. And it's my package is right here on my desk. I just, you know, grab it every single day, and there we go. It's a nice little gift to yourself, if you will, and a gift to your health. Care/of. Check it out for yourself and get 50% off your first month of personalized Care/of vitamins. Go to takecareof.com. Enter code GT50, okay? 50% off that first month of personalized Care/of vitamins. Takecareof.com. Enter code GT50. Now, back to the show.
And that was, he had this servant. I can't remember his name, but, you know, that was his favorite person on the property. And that servant, you know, they stayed on the grounds and that he built him like a small little, it's almost like a cottage looking thing. And, you know, that's where he lived, close to the house. It's where the other servants and the other slaves, they ended up a little bit further down the road. Because, you know, back then they didn't build the servants' quarters close to the house. But for this one, he did. And there was one day when the servant, he was kicked in the head by a horse. And he was basically just sprawled out in the yard. He was pretty much dead. But Dr. Nixon, he thought he could bring him back. And so he rushed him up into the office, basically told everyone, leave me alone until he's back to life. And he started working on that servant for about a day and a half, even though he was pretty much dead when the horse kicked him in the back of the head. And after a while, Dr. Nixon seen, I guess he finally realized there was nothing to be done. So he didn't bury him. That was the thing. He ended up taking, now this is something that did actually happen. We do know that this happened. He took off his flesh and then got his bones and boiled them and clean them up and basically turned him into a skeleton. And one of the reasons for this was he saw in a lot of modern clinics in towns like Richmond that a lot of these quote-unquote professional rich doctors had these cool-looking models of what the inside of the human body looks like. And you can see the skeleton in every bone, and the kids thought it was really cool. It made you look really esteemed and established. And Dr. Nixon Sneed, he wanted one, but he couldn't afford one. And so, you know, like I said, he basically transformed his old servant into a stand-up skeleton model. And he kept him in his office. It said that he took the boiled flesh and dumped it in the yard and didn't tell anyone what he did. What happened was everyone just walked in and was like, hey, you have one of those model skeletons, huh? Cool. But no one knew. And of course, you know, back then they didn't really care about the well-being of servants very often. So, you know, no one asked what happened to his body. So that stayed for a very long time. And something that I found that's a little disturbing was kids would come into his office. They would sneak. It's almost like a rite of passage for the kids. They would go upstairs and they'd be like, hey, it looks like a real dead body. I bet you can't steal a bone from it. I bet you can't take a finger. And, you know, it turns out it was a real dead body. And so over time, you know, more and more pieces of that guy's skeleton would be missing. So Dr. Nickerson, he got very angry about this. And he ended up taking the skeleton out and he buried it somewhere in the yard of the side of the house. We don't know exactly where, but all it's known is it's somewhere in the yard close to where his office was. And about this time, his wife had another child. And then the Civil War came. And the Civil War, for a place that was a major hub of activity, it didn't really experience too much action aside from some troop movements, some resupplying, but that was really it. The house was used as a field hospital and as a morgue during the war, and it is known that during some local skirmishes, mainly in 1864, some of the army, both Union and Confederate, they would take, you know, their wounded and dead and have Dr. Nickerson patch them up. And for some of them, they would take their bodies into the basement, which they transformed into this big morgue. And if it was wintertime, you couldn't bury people because the ground was frozen solid. And so they would just leave the bodies there until spring. And so, you know, in war, a lot of people tend to die. And Dr. Nickerson said he was a good doctor, but he wasn't good enough to perform the operations needed to save a lot of lives. And so, you know, bodies started racking up quickly inside the basement. And so it got to the point to where sometimes they would even be stacking bodies on the stairs going down to the basement. And then eventually they would take the bodies either back to their homes or they would bury them in the local cemetery, which is about half a mile away. And then in the 1870s, Dr. Nickerson Sneed, he died. And then his wife died. And the Mason family took over. Now, the Mason family, when they took over, they had the house from about the late 1870s up until, I believe, about the 1970s. It went through the family almost 100 years. Instantly, when they came in, there were ghost stories of the old doctor still in his office, and people would see the woman in blue walking around the house, and, you know, that was Betsy Sneed. And so the Mason family, they kept it. They did a little work on it. It was a very strange design because Dr. Nickerson Sneed, when he would add additions to the house, he wouldn't tear down what was there before. He just kind of encased everything. Like, there was a point in, I believe, the late 1840s, outside his office, he put another room. And then he had, like, a little porch where you can walk on. People can stand and wait until it's their turn. And in the 1860s, he built a few more bedrooms, and he decided, well, I'm just going to make this an upstairs. And instead of taking down the porch, he just enclosed it, encased it. And that's why when you're in the building today, it's a very weird feeling going up the stairs because, you know, there's brick next to you. You can tell that there's an outside window on the inside. It doesn't look right. And then when you get upstairs to the quote-unquote landing, it feels and looks like a back porch. It's just very weird. And then we get to about the 1930s when the Mason family still has it. And there was a death that was not really strange, but it could have been prevented. There was someone who had a little bit of a heat stroke. And, you know, the family, they took them out to the back porch and said, oh, crap, we have to go call somebody. And, you know, they left the person there. No one was watching them. And that person apparently did try to call for help a little bit, but no one heard them because, you know, people were inside calling, I guess, the local ambulance or, you know, they were freaking out. And that person ended up dying on the back porch. And that was, for the Mason family, a little bit of a traumatic event. It was said that the house was never really as cheerful as it once was, and it's also said that paranormal activity increased. So the house, it hasn't seen many owners since it was built in the 1740s, and even going back to the 1870s, 1880s, it has a reputation for being haunted. Now, a lot of psychics that come in, for those of you listening out there, you can take psychics as you will, whether, you know, at their word or with a grain of salt, whatever you believe. But a lot of them have said that because the Cherokee tribes were run out of their fall festival area and out of their spiritually rich and important environment, that there is a little bit of a curse put on the place, that, you know, nothing will ever truly thrive here. And that some of the spirits of the woods they were basically sent to run those people out of what's the Nickerson Sneed House. So it's very strange how all of that just kind of comes into play in a place that has not seen as much death and as much trauma as some other places, but it's still more active than other places based on what took place around the area, not just in the house.
Sure. Very active piece of land with a lot of stuff that occurred there and within its walls itself. When we start talking about the property having haunting occurrences going on in it, people are recognizing there is something odd going on here. When does it actually start to go from just, oh, there's rumors of ghosts, to people actually looking into the place in early forms of ghost investigating? What are some of those? Who are some of those people, and when did that start?
That started about in the 1980s, okay, when the current owners, Rhonda Caudill and her husband, they bought the place from the Mason family. And I've talked to her many, many times about this. And she said, well, as soon as they came in, when they were looking at the house, because, you know, it was a similar path. They were from Northern Virginia, I believe, and they were just looking for something new. They wanted something old, something cool looking, because, you know, even back then they were into the paranormal and just creepy houses. And she told me that their agent was like, here, I've got this place, and this place, but here, let's go look at it. And she was like, well, as we're going by, there was one place slightly out of our budget, but our agent listed it for some reason as, hey, it's out of your budget, but it's a cool house and it's old. Let's go check it out. And so she said as soon as they got there, it was as if the house was calling her, as if, you know, it wouldn't let her leave without her agreeing to buy the place. And they took a walk around, and she said it's weird. It was as if she had been there before. It felt like a very strong sense of deja vu. She knew, strangely enough, where everything was. She was able to get around the house, not really any problems. And so they ended up buying the house. And as soon as they moved in, because originally it was just going to be, you know, their house. And then they started hearing footsteps. Then they started seeing the woman in blue, which is, like I said, Betsy Sneed. They didn't have any experiences with Dr. Nickerson Sneed. Not really anyone has anymore, aside from a few one-off occasions. But it's mostly Betsy Sneed that people have experienced, mainly Rhonda and her husband. And then there's two little kids, Josephine, and I can't remember the name of the other one, but they are from the Mason family. And I'm not really sure if there were kids that died in the home or something like that. That bit of history hasn't been clear to me, but they haunt the place. And there's this one specific kid's room that they had set up, and it was kind of when they first moved in, it was a little bit of a storage room, so not many people were going in and out of there. And if you know how paranormal experiences work, paranormal activity works, typically spirits will take up residence in a room in a house that doesn't see a lot of human traffic, kind of like, you know, like their own room, a place where they can have privacy, a place of kind of like a base of operations. They can manifest and come and go as they please, and that's kind of what that room became when the Caudills moved in. And first it was just the two little kids. They would hear what sound like kids playing. There was this little toy piano that sometimes, it's very creepy. It is one of the creepiest pianos I've ever heard. And sometimes they would hear a few notes being played on it, which for me at that point, I would have probably sold the house at that point. But it was really just something to where, you know, it freaked them out at first. It disturbed them. And then they just kind of learned to live with it. And then there would be nights where it would sound like the front door was kicked in by the SWAT team, like they were coming to get you. And so they go downstairs and the door's locked. The door's fine. And then they go back to bed. It'd be the same thing, but the door's locked. It's front and back. It's bolted. It's an old lock. And then they would hear it again on another night. And this time the door would be open. And that's something that still happens to this day. I've actually witnessed this myself during a seance, the front door sounding like it was kicked in really hard. And that was something that started happening a bit more and more. And something that ended up happening as well was a little bit before the Caudills bought it. the Mason family had an antique store that was there. And this must have been about the 50s and 60s is about when this was. And one of their sons was an avid collector of mainly everything. And one of the things that he just happened to be collecting that was in very high demand for his business was creepy dolls. And there was one story, I did talk to a member of the Mason family about this, and she told me that there was one doll that came in one day that he bought in, I believe it was the Chesapeake Bay, I think is where she said he bought it from. But ever since he brought that doll in, a lot of activity has kind of skyrocketed. And that doll has been seen moving by the Mason family. It would change positions sometimes. They would hear a female voice that would seemingly be coming from the doll. And so eventually they got rid of the doll. And they got rid of the other dolls just in case they decided to make their presence known. And the antique store went on for a little bit more. And then they transformed it into a restaurant. And then during this restaurant time, people would complain almost nightly that, hey, we came in your restaurant, and this woman in a beautiful blue dress would look at us, but she wouldn't see us. And it's like she wasn't there. She wouldn't respond to us. She wouldn't help us with our questions. Nothing. And so the owners, they'd be like, what girl in a blue dress? And then, you know, that's when the customer's like, ah, and they start freaking out. Because, you know, who is this phantom hostess? Sure. And, you know, like I said earlier, the woman in blue is Betsy Sneed. And apparently she is very, very attached to the location. And every single time, whether a new family would come in or basically a change was made to the house, she would be seen almost nightly. And she would always make her presence known, kind of just what I gather to keep track. Make sure, you know, they're not destroying the house, they're not desecrating it. And so that's really when they start doing, quote unquote, investigations about the 1990s. And then the Caudills, they ended up moving out of the house, but they still kept, and they were originally going to make it almost like a B&B type thing. They were going to rent it out to people, but some of the people that rented it out, you know, they complained about voices, sometimes hearing screams and moans, and of course the front door being kicked in. No one felt safe. And so about the early to mid-2000s is when they started having actual paranormal investigations there, and they had a few teams come in. About 2004, I believe, was the very first one, and it was a very supercharged location. And ever since that first investigation, it's almost like the spirits make it their mission to make their presence known.
When you're in there and in an investigation, what sort of feeling are you getting? Are these good spirits? Are these protective spirits? Is it a lot of different spirits that are present? What's going on with these spirits that are making themselves known?
Well, first, when you walk up to the building, when you get there, it almost looks like a scaled-down version of the Haunted Mansion. You drive up, there's this little ridge that you go up, and there's two pillars that have old-fashioned lanterns on them, and they're lit up. And then the house, there's just two windows that's usually lit at night, and it almost looks like an Amityville type scene. And so when you go into the house, you're already a little creeped out, and you're walking up this old brick walkway that was laid down in the 1830s. You get onto the porch, you hear the creak of the wood. The door is a little stuck because, you know, it's been there since 1835, 1836. And as soon as you enter in, it's almost like you can feel people greeting you. And downstairs, especially in the front few rooms, it's a very welcoming environment. You know, you feel almost like whatever is there, you know, welcomes you. It's like, hey, welcome to the house. Make yourself at home. And then you go upstairs. And upstairs around the doctor's office, you get a sense that, you know, this is cool. I don't feel like I'm going to die here, but I feel like something's watching me. And so I do believe that even though he doesn't really make his friends known, I think Dr. Nickerson Sneed is still around his office.
That wraps up part one of our interview with Jake Fife about the Nickerson Sneed House. In part two of our interview, we will discuss Dr. Sneed. Exactly what was he involved in? Was there anything questionable in his medical practices, or was he more insulted by an accusation of his death from a paranormal investigator which caused some dark energy to move throughout the house. Is there, in fact, a demonic entity that is feeding off the curious energy that surrounds the home? Who's the woman in blue who haunts the Nickerson-Snead house? Do the spirits from different generations interact with one another at the Nickerson-Snead house? Who's a doppelganger that appears and imitates the living in this haunted house? Also, what paranormal activity is connected to the statue of a dog at this house? All that and more in part two of our interview. You can hear it if you're a grave keeper. Sign up to become one on our website at patreon.com/thegravetalks or thegravetalks.com. Click become a grave keeper. $5 a month gets you access to this and all of our part two interviews of all of our episodes. And you get advanced access to all of our episodes as well, months before they go public. It's your chance to binge away on many, many episodes of The Grave Talks months before the rest of the world gets a chance to hear them. And those exclusive part two interviews as well. Check it out, patreon.com/thegravetalks or thegravetalks.com. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.